to care about it all less than ever. I find it hard to talk about my mother without becoming overwhelmed, and so I talk about my states of mind. I try to be forensic. I say grief is like a drug, or a dream, like a long, slow panic attack, or like seeing everything, finally, for what it is. Harry tells me his father died 3 years ago, and that there have been times since when he's felt closer to him than he ever did in life. He says he read a lot about grief in the year or so after. Not self-help books, but stark meditations on death. Seneca and Montaigne and Roland Barthes. What does it mean, he asks, when people say, she's out of her misery? Why the present tense? Who's this she we're speaking of? I smile wanly. I like it, he says. I don't believe there's anything after, but I like that present tense that makes no sense. Harry is in his late 50s, dark-haired. One of his legs is impaired. I'm not sure why. Perhaps he had polio. He might be just old enough to have contracted it before it was eradicated here. He walks with a stick. There is something thoughtful and contained about him, but also a sprightliness. He laughs readily. He seems like someone who has learned the hard way that the best means of surviving it all is a sense of humor. Harry had wanted to be a historian, but he abandoned his PhD. He decided, after seeing a program on the BBC about waves of displacement during the Angolan Civil War, that he didn't want an ivory tower life. He apprenticed himself to a small NGO and learned everything he could about shelter. He says we met once before, when we were both working for the UN in Kosovo, though I have no memory of it. I thought I knew him only through email, and as a voice emanating from a starfish-shaped box splayed on a table in a conference room. But he insists we were once on the same assignment to a Roma camp outside Mitrovica. I ask him if he isn't confusing me with someone else, and he keeps saying, I can't believe you don't remember. Sorry, I say. I'm surprised I don't remember. Partly because Harry feels familiar to me, uncannily so. But also because I remember the mission itself, or at least the mood that hung over it. It was summer. It had rained all morning, heavily, and the air was hot and wet. The sky was still low, and a gully of gray water ran down the muddy slope that separated the shacks. The camp was near a disused mine, and there was a slag heap visible above the tree line. Children gathered around us, listless and blank-eyed. The atmosphere could hardly have been bleaker. Harry says he read the report I circulated afterwards, and that it was thorough and detailed. The report I have no recollection of. From my years in the field, I remember little of all the facts and figures and timelines I assembled, assessed, disseminated. What I remember are impressions and images, and people who were more interesting as symbols than as individuals. I remember Irish women getting deep tissue massage and complaining about the help, half in love with the ironies of neo-colonialism. I remember the night a Scottish woman, she'd worked in all the world's dodgiest places, Colombia and Iraq and Somalia, stepped out of a bar in Mombasa and was killed by a passing car driven by a drunk German. I remember buying roasted chestnuts from a cart in a square in Belgrade one late October afternoon when you could feel the season turning, winter setting in smoky and cold, and all around me old, old Europe, so burdened and war-weary and rich in loss. And one evening in Batacaloa that I remember more clearly than any other, I was sitting with three colleagues and two local teenagers drinking tea in a cement-floored room open to the warm night. Rubber prostheses, arms and below the knees and whole legs, dangling around the room's perimeter like a dozen disassembled mannequins. Something vaguely fetishistic about them. When into our midst wandered a big-bellied water monitor, its skin like an oyster shell, looking as old as time itself. And we all went still, while above us the limb swayed slightly in the breeze, and the 5-foot-long lizard oozed across the floor. And though I saw it all for the cheaply surrealist snapshot that it was, I knew that I had witnessed few moments in the world as strangely beautiful as this one. Sri Lanka had been my first overseas posting in 1996. I had left Eddie, I had left our house on the slope of the mountain, and fled to Dublin, where I got a job at an architectural trade magazine. One evening I went for drinks with a workmate and her sister, who was home on leave from her job as a protection officer for the UN in Colombo. I had never met anyone who did that sort of work, and I was fascinated. I badgered her with questions. When she asked about my life, I said I was in transition. Bored to tears with my job and wondering what the next step should be. Before the night was out, she was promising to arrange a phone interview for a volunteer post in the information department of the country office in Batticaloa. I thought it would be a brief interlude, an adventure, but that sort of life can become a habit. It has a way of filling in the blanks, the esprit de corps and the gallows humor, and sometimes history happening before your eyes. These things tell you that you matter, that your days have a purpose. A form of institutionalization sets in, so that now I have the strange feeling I've been released back into the wild. Life on Earth, Harry calls it, meaning a middle-class existence in a developed country where one has no special status and where nothing too obviously atrocious is going on. It's a bit of a change, he says. His tone is wry. Then he looks me in the eye and says kindly, "Be careful not to isolate." "I know," I say, though I also know that isolating is precisely my impulse when in the thick of grief. Neither of us moves. We've been sitting for almost an hour and have agreed on an outline for my report. The usual sections, shelter, food, health, sanitation, a special section on camp prostitution, another on security issues, and, to show it isn't all doom and gloom, a third on entrepreneurship within the camp. Mostly, though, we've talked about things other than the report. Parents and mourning. How we went abroad to begin with, and where I might settle now. The changes Dublin has undergone. We are like any two people who have spent a long time in the same line of work. A lot goes without saying, and my report won't reinvent the wheel. Harry looks at his watch, and I look at mine. "You'll be all right?" He gives me a little smile, so his worry doesn't worry me, I guess. "Of course," I say. "We'll meet next week?" "Next week?" "Lunch," he says happily. I know what he's doing. He thinks I need keeping an eye on. "You don't have to," I say. "I know I don't." For a moment, I have to look away. In my current state, kindness slays me. When I've pulled myself together, I say, "Whatever day suits you." We agree on Friday. Then he pays for our coffees, and we step out onto Stephen's Green and say goodbye. During the year between our engagement and the wedding, I had flashes of doubt about what we were doing, which I felt guilty for harboring and didn't mention to Eddie. I was in love with him and wanted badly to rise to the occasion of his offer of his life and his love. But there were things about him that I needed to come to terms with, or not, on my own. I needed to accept that I was leaving my country forever, because it seemed unlikely that Eddie would ever leave his. I also needed to accept that Eddie was never going to be a man who spoke easily, if at all, of his inner world. That he was a man of doing, not dwelling upon, and that though this might at times inspire a certain confidence, the proof of his love visible in his actions, it might also mean that there was a limit on how deeply I could ever know him. And I felt a stab of loneliness when I thought of this. I felt it keenly not long after our engagement. His mother's oldest and dearest friend had died, a woman Eddie had known since childhood, and for whom he'd had great affection. I had gone with him to the funeral, and afterwards to the gathering at her daughter's house. And I had watched Eddie, and hadn't known whether to be impressed or disconcerted by his self-possession. The following day, I had tried to talk to him about this woman, and what she'd meant to him. And I could feel him closing up, shrugging off my attempt. I said it seemed important to talk about these losses, and he said that sometimes silence was a form of respect. I told him that I understood that, but actually I didn't. I thought it was fear, a refusal to allow himself to feel uncomfortable, to lose control even for an instant. And I couldn't help resenting it, that refusal that seemed somehow directed at me, or at life. And yet I knew that he had ferried his mother back and forth to visit this woman in the hospital, that he had visited her himself throughout her illness, and offered practical help to her daughter. I knew that he'd been solid and present, and that when his mother became disoriented with grief, he had steadied her. But still, he wouldn't speak about it all, and I wasn't sure I could live with such silences. And then, one night, I had what felt like a conversion experience. I allowed myself to accept, with what seemed like my whole heart, a future with Eddie. It wasn't a decision. Even allowed isn't the right word. And that was why it felt like something I could trust. It was a spring evening, and I had returned to town from a particularly unpleasant encounter with a man I was interviewing near Donegal Town. I had been freelancing for two papers in Dublin, and I occasionally wrote pieces for the horrendous local weekly. The work gave me some sense of having a life, a self, that existed outside Eddie's orbit, though it was piecemeal enough, and my subjects sufficiently trivial, that it also left me feeling more like a Sunday painter than a journalist. The man I met that day had been accused by neighbors of building on land that wasn't his own, and the episode had escalated into news because the man had grown belligerent and begun obstructing a nearby access road with his tractors, and was now receiving anonymous threats to both his property and his person. The whole thing struck me as silly, and I suspect my attitude betrayed this, because we weren't talking 3 minutes when the man, who is sitting on a bench in a cafe with his head thrust towards me and his two hands planted on his spread open thighs, began haranguing me, to the point where I eventually left the interview shaking, ashamed of myself for letting him reduce me to such a state. Heading home in a downpour, I narrowly avoided plowing into the back of another car as I rounded a bend on the main Donegal Road. It had only one dim taillight and was traveling at a crawl in a 100 km/h zone. I swerved to avoid it and fishtailed on the wet road before regaining control. The minute I walked through the door of his flat, Eddie could see that I was upset. He sat me down and made me a drink, and I told him first about the near miss on the road, and then about the Donegal man. He put his arm around me and smoothed my hair. It was pitch black out, and I could hear the rain drumming on the windows. I kept replaying in my mind the scene on the road, feeling the car lurching beneath me. The terrifying realization that I was not in control. I buried my face in Eddie's neck, feeling as safe as I could ever recall having felt, and pressed closer to him on the sofa. His hand tensed on my skull, and the moment turned abruptly sexual, and we wound up making love on the floor. It was afterwards, as we lay there, tangled in our own clothes, and still lazily aroused by that unexpected onrush of desire, that I surrendered to our future. Yes, I thought. We can make a life together. We married in Sligo Cathedral on a fresh September day. The reception was at the family home, in a marquee set up on the lawn. The sun shone, and a jazz quartet played. And even Eddie's father seemed cheerful. Camille and Jane were my bridesmaids. 2 weeks before the wedding, they had insisted on a night out. Jane, who had graduated from the local tech with a degree in environmental science and now had a job monitoring water quality, rounded up three other women, extras whose names I hardly knew, and we went out on the town. None of us was the hen party type, and none of us, at least that we admitted, regarded marriage as a deliverance from the perilous state of being unmarried. But I went along with it, out of what felt like superstition. Camille had gotten herself a job in a Celtic jewelry shop in town, and the women had bought me a pendant with one of those triple swirls, which I wore all night and never again. At 2 a.m., they walked me down to Eddie's flat, all of us arm in arm and in an out-of-season sing-song of, I'm embarrassed to say, Fairy Tale of New York. When we got to Eddie's, we shouted up to his window until, finally, the sash was raised and Eddie leaned out, like an imprisoned princess, which caused my companions to howl lewdly, but reduced me to a besotted silence. He came down and unlocked the door. "You survived," he said, smiling sleepily, and I wrapped my arms around him and felt delivered, like a baby, into his care. My mother traveled over from Portland with Stan. She took to Eddie immediately, which was both a relief and a surprise. My mother had disapproved of every boyfriend I'd ever had, up to and including the impatient columnist. She feared that I would fall for a man of inconstant character and find myself disappointed and saddled with a future I hadn't bargained for. By then, I knew that wasn't quite how she saw her story with my father, or the task of raising me. But I also knew that her apprehensiveness about my choices was informed by her own life. She and my father had dated during the semester he was in Portland, a romance that hadn't evolved into something serious. "We wouldn't have made each other happy," my mother said, when I was old enough to press for details. When my mother became pregnant towards the end of that spring, a surprise to both of them, she didn't try to persuade my father to stay in Portland, nor did she ask him to take her to Maine with him. It was brave of her, really, to go it alone, but my mother was in some respects ahead of her time. They said their goodbyes and went their very separate ways. At some point during my childhood, I became aware that he sent a sum of money every month towards my care. I didn't meet my father until I was 11 years old. He had sent a letter to my mother, asking her to share it with me if she thought it best. He'd got married a couple years previously. He and his wife did not plan to have children. His wife, however, had known about me since they'd met, and it was at her behest, rightly, he said, for the lack of contact with his daughter had sat uneasily with him for years, that he was writing. He said that he didn't know if he knew how to be a father, or to what extent my mother, or I, wanted him to be. The last thing he wanted, he said, was to upset our domestic harmony. He used that phrase, domestic harmony. His tone throughout, in fact, was of such formality that I imagined him ashen and bespectacled, standing at a lectern. He didn't sound like much fun, which didn't mean I wasn't breathless with excitement at the thought of him. I hoped that I would learn something about him that would enable me to understand his capacity to absent himself as he had, something that would cast him in a noble light and relieve me of the suspicion that some deficiency of mine had made it easy, or necessary, for him to stay away. And so began our tentative and, as it turned out, short-lived relationship, an exchange of letters that led to his visiting Portland on his own a few months later. We did well, I think, that weekend, for two people so stunned by the sudden, unfamiliar reality of the other. He was staying at a nearby hotel, and on the Saturday, he picked me up at our house, and we went for lunch down on the waterfront and took a boat tour up the river. On the Sunday, we went to Multnomah Falls for a gentle hike, which offered a context for togetherness without the necessity of constant conversation. In the evenings, we had dinner with my mother, which presented its own strain, but at least relieved us of the intensity of being alone together. My parents didn't seem overly uncomfortable with each other, and I imagined, what child wouldn't in such a situation, what a perfectly nice family the three of us might someday make. All that weekend, there was a palpable restraint in my father, which I decided was due to nothing more than our newness to each other, and which I quickly made it my life's great cause to overcome. The minute he left, I wrote him a letter, and I can still recall its effusiveness, a kind of courage I can't but admire. This project of mine filled me with hope, a hope suffused, as perhaps all hope is, with anxiety, for I believed that somewhere in my repertoire of being existed the equivalent of a magic word, a fact about me as yet unknown to him, a side of me he hadn't seen, the sheer hidden wonder of me, and that I must locate it, so that with it I could perforate that reserve of his, enabling his love for me to break helplessly through. Oh, what power absence wields! I would have tied myself in knots for him if only I'd known how, and my poor, devoted mother witnessed to it all. Of all the boys I would pine for in the years to come, I don't think anything compared with the near slavishness of my desire for my father's affection. I saw him again a few months after the first visit. He had attended a conference in Seattle, then driven down to spend a day and an evening with us. It was during that weekend that it was agreed I would visit him and his wife during the upcoming summer vacation. This visit never happened. For 3 months later, my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. I had the feeling my mother was angry with him for becoming ill, which hardly made sense. Later, I wondered if she'd suspected him of knowing all along that he was ill, and that being the reason he'd finally sought me out, which wouldn't have been the worst crime, and possibly not a crime at all. But I don't think he did know when he wrote that first letter, or on either of the visits. He didn't seem at all sickly, and though he was self-contained, he was nothing like the graying, sedentary figure I'd imagined. He was someone who loved to swim and hike almost as much as he loved to read and write, and I don't recall there having been any whiff of morbidity about him. I was devastated by his death. He was a future snatched from me just as I had glimpsed it, but there was, at the same time, a discomforting sense in which death seemed to return him to his natural state. For in the years before I met him, my father had often seemed oddly posthumous to me, a distant ancestor rather than the person who begot me. I don't know what would have become of us had he lived. I think that, in his own reluctant way, he wanted to know me, and for me to know him. But I think there were limits, too, to his capacity to absorb me into his life, and I can imagine that as I got older and felt the need of a father less, I might have closed the door, unwilling to forgive him his years of absence. My mother remained single while I was growing up, though she went on the occasional date, perhaps more dates than I was aware of. Her social world consisted mainly of women she played bridge with at a club in Portland, and with whom she went to dinner or the movies. From her work at the university, she had developed an interest in philosophy, and sometimes she went to talks on campus and read books that professors in the department had written or contributed to. She was able to immerse herself in some of those books, and she would read out bits to me, wonderstruck. Others, I could tell, were too dense or challenging. She would be sitting in her armchair, and a look of self-consciousness would come over her, and she would leaf ahead to see if it got easier, and then quietly put the book aside and take up something else. My mother was by no means unintelligent, but I have a sense of her as someone caught between worlds or eras, not drawn to the more obvious and conventional roles available to her, but not sure enough of herself to carve out a life of greater challenge or stimulation. She had earned her undergraduate degree in English, and I know that she lived with a diffident desire to be more than a glorified secretary. But being around all those clever men, the department was staffed entirely by men throughout her time there, reinforced her sense of being not clever enough, for though they were all fond of her and relied on her enormously, not one of them encouraged her to expand her horizons. And my mother was someone who needed that sort of permission. Once I saw her with a man I didn't know. I was 10 years old. I had come downtown with a friend and her older sister. It was the lunch hour of a summer day, a work day for my mother. We were passing a little eatery, looking idly in the window, and there she was. I could see her through the glass, shaking her head and smiling, as a balding, not bad-looking man gestured rather wildly, in a manner clearly meant to amuse her. Before I'd even thought what I was doing, or considered the advantages of spying on her, I had left my friend and her sister on the street and burst in upon them. In the egoism of early adolescence, I hadn't seriously considered the idea that my mother might have, or want, or be entitled to a private life. It was only on seeing her that day, seeing her face when she caught sight of me over her companion's shoulder, the brief, slight flackening of her features as her laughter subsided, that strange look in her eyes, a as though she was trying to place me, before she recovered her wits and perked up and said, with what sounded like genuine pleasure, "Alice, what are you doing here?" That it dawned on me that I was not everything in the world to her. She introduced the man as my friend David, a professor of English at the university, and he greeted me by way of a courtly nod, followed by a broad smile and an offer to join them. He seemed jovial and hearty, and somehow not a man I could imagine my mother loving. Anyway, I don't think there was anything significant between her and David, but that isn't the point. The point is that I'd awakened to her loneliness, her sense of incompleteness, which was, after all, perfectly natural. And instead of growing empathetic, I took it personally. I made a show that evening at home of trying to convey my upset, while trying at the same time to make it look to her that I was, for her sake, covering up how truly upset I was. I'd like to think she saw through this act, and that those years she went without intimacy were the result of not meeting the right man, and not of the success of my manipulations. What I feared, I think, was my mother erring, and the result being a reprise of our first abandonment. Only this time, somehow, I would lose her, too. I had one certain parent, and one missing parent, and I was not about to gamble what I had in hope of doubling my luck. Meanwhile, I wanted my real father. Throughout my childhood, and even more intensely once I'd met him, I felt my father's absence, like an undertow, a pull in the direction of the unknown and the ideal. I imagined that if I transformed into the magic thing, a boy, a girl child who needed nothing and provided unalloyed delight, then all the pieces and the people would fall into place. Even when I grew old enough to accept that the person I longed for simply did not exist, firstly, because my father was incapable of being what I needed him to be, and then because he died, the pull did not subside. By then, the longing had detached itself from its object and become something free-floating, something quietly ravenous. A few nights before the wedding, my mother and Stan and Eddie and I were having dinner at a converted castle south of Sligo. Eddie was talking about his business and about furniture, and Stan, who had spent most of his working life as a financial planner, was nodding earnestly, saying, "You bet," and "You're on to something there." I noticed my mother looking at Eddie in a very particular way, and I knew immediately what she was seeing. Completion, stability, containment. I turned to Eddie. I hadn't really been listening to what he was saying, something about educating people to become more sophisticated consumers, and I put my hand on his thigh under the table. I saw the corner of his mouth twitch. I wanted to run my hands all over him, his shoulders, his broad back, to cup the nape of his neck in my palm. I wanted to consume him. When I glanced back at my mother, I saw that she was looking at me. She gave me a little smile, proud and collusive and relieved. I was safe. Her work here was done. Eddie and I rented a house in town and commenced being married. It was a small place, and we viewed it as temporary. We had talked about where we might buy a house, whether we could get something near the sea, or maybe in the countryside. But for now, I liked being in the town, able to step outside the door and be in the midst of things. That first year, I didn't feel terribly different, and I wasn't sure if that was an indication that marriage was our natural state, or if it meant that some part of me didn't quite believe what we had done. I had the sense that we were still in the prelude of our life together, and I wondered whether this feeling was common to couples who had not yet had children. Eddie's mother mellowed towards me after we were married, and a certain deference entered her attitude. By assuming the status of wife, I had become, in her eyes, a woman to be taken seriously. This struck me as silly, and the truth was that I felt diminished by my new status. I hadn't changed my name, but when a card or letter came addressed to us both, it was often the case that I now had neither a first nor a last name. I had simply been collapsed into a missus. What disturbed me more than the thing itself, though, was the seductiveness of that collapse. Here it was, a ready-made role that I had only to inhabit, where the expectations were clear and the rewards understood. It was all so simple, or could be if I let it. I felt the lure most keenly on Sundays, when we went to Eddie's parents' place for lunch. There was the proper glass for every drink course. The aperitif, the red and white wines, the liqueur, the port, and as I sat there with a crystal tumbler heavy in my hand, I felt the world acquire a density and depth that it had never had before. I realized that all my life I had felt insufficiently anchored. I recall a certain wind-swept Sunday. We had all retired to the sitting room for a smoke and a cognac after lunch, the fire crackling demurely in its grate, and feeling a sudden surge of impatience to bring children into this mix, to see them, two, maybe three, sitting on the carpet like little angels, playing with their wooden toys, and thinking that if I could just give myself to this sweet tableau I saw before me, I would always know who I was, and who I belonged to, and what was required of me. Our social life revolved mostly around Eddie's friends, the couples he'd introduced me to that first summer, people who wanted nothing from me other than that I enter into the spirit of the evening, keep up with the drinking, and occasionally utter something unexpected. They hardly knew me, nor I them, and in their company I found it possible to hide in plain sight. I kept freelancing for papers in Dublin, but there was only so much news from Sligo that the national media were interested in, and if there was anything really big, they sent their own people to cover it. When the regional radio station opened, I began to do the occasional story for them. The oldest woman in the country celebrates her birthday. A young man punches a punching bag for a world record 42 hours. The efforts of the Tidy Towns Committee. My assignments were not enough to occupy me fully, and there were evenings when I found myself exaggerating the labors of the day. Eddie didn't seem to notice, or perhaps thought it normal that I, his wife, should pass hours each week engaged in nothing in particular. Every so often, I did get to go to Dublin for work, each time boarding the train with a frisson of excitement, and each time feeling more daunted upon arriving. One fine autumn afternoon, I sat in the garden of an advertising firm in Ballsbridge with a man named Niall, eating salmon and glass noodles, in a near paralysis of inadequacy. I was researching a local boy-made-good piece. Niall hailed from a South Sligo backwater and had gone abroad in the early 80s when the country was economically stagnant and choking on coal smoke. Now he'd come home, all spit and polish, proud to be Irish, and with a vague air of plunder about him. Niall embodied an attitude that would become widespread, one that saw the sudden upsurge in the nation's fortunes as a form of moral restitution. He wore pressed denims and slip-on loafers of the softest leather, and a sky-blue cashmere V-neck that set off the traces of grey at his temples. He was demurely wealthy, smooth as agate, and he was giving me an hour of his time. Around us in the garden, young people sat on the edge of their cast-iron seats, jabbering excitedly into one another's faces, lit by some creative or acquisitive fire. Gone was the gormlessness I had associated with Irish 20-somethings, the slouch, the intern shoulders, the physique somehow thinnish and doughy at the same time. Gone was that air of expecting, at any moment, to be embarrassed. They looked amoral and eternally young. It was like witnessing the advent of a new species. Am I exaggerating? Possibly. But I'd grown countrified. I, who had once felt so brash and new world, now felt slow-witted and gauche. Returning home on the train that evening, the clouds gathering over Leitrim, as they invariably did, I could feel my insides tightening, a morning after despair gnawing at me, as though I had lost something dear to me, but could not quite recall what it was. As the economy improved, Eddie's business steadily expanded. He was well positioned to supply the new housing estates that were beginning to proliferate, and to meet the more rarefied needs of the first wave of nouveau riche. He started to travel more, often just to Dublin, but sometimes to England or the continent. In the beginning, I often went with him, but increasingly, I stayed at home. I spent the evenings he was away reading or watching videos, or going out with Camille or Jane, sometimes to the little cinema on Wine Street, sometimes for drinks or a meal. One night, at closing time, Jane and I ran into the guys from the band I'd partied with that first summer, and had hardly seen since. Jane was ready to go home, but I agreed to go on with them for a late drink. We went to the hotel on the bridge, a flat-roofed affair from the 60s that must have been the height of luxury in its day, but now looked dismal and tired. We got a table in the corner of the bar and ordered pints. I bought a pack of Silk Cut, though I rarely smoked then, and we all puffed away like mad. And the boys teased me about being let out for the night. "You're made up now," one of them said. It wasn't the first time I'd heard that line, or variations on it, and I always ignored it. But tonight, because I was drunk, I said, "If I'd been looking to get made up, this town wouldn't have been my first stop." The sharpness of my tone surprised them. Martin tapped a cigarette on the outside of the box. "Ah, now," he said. It was one of those catch-all phrases of placation that drove me insane. "Ah, now what?" I said. Frank stared at his lap. One of the others winked at me. Not in a smarmy way, but conciliatory. Now I felt ashamed. They had thought of me, in the long ago, as one of them. And all they wanted now was for me to agree that I was made up. That we, those of us who cared about things other than money, had got one over on the mercantile class. Only I didn't feel that way. I was an American from the suburbs, and though Eddie's family might have been more polished in some ways than my own, I could hardly view them as a class enemy. At one point, I looked over towards the bar. The man who owned the hotel was standing there. He knew Eddie from the Chamber of Commerce, and he saw me and nodded. His eyes took in my companions, and he hesitated for a moment, then turned away. When I went up to the bar shortly after to order another round, he materialized beside me and said, "What have you done with himself?" "Sent him packing," I said flatly. I was tired of existing only in relation to Eddie. "He's in France." With an oily little smile, he said, "If it was me, I'd have taken you along." "Would you?" I said. "I would," he said. "Well, I didn't want to go. I had things to do here." He glanced in the direction of the boys. The barman said he'd drop the drinks down, and I gathered up my change and pocketed it. The owner and I looked at each other, the way you do, and he said, "I should buy you a drink later." And I said, "Should you?" and laughed brazenly and turned away. The boys and I stayed at the hotel until they stopped serving, and then we went to one of the grungier late-night discos. I danced until 2 in the morning, and every second person said to me, "Where's Eddie?" When Eddie got home the following day, I felt unwholesome, as though I had actually cheated on him. He didn't ask what I'd done the night before. He wanted to tell me about the deal he'd closed to become the rep for a line of French dining suites. He was standing in the kitchen, and I came up and put my arms around his waist and ran them up his chest and down again. He squirmed a little, slipped out of my embrace, and said, "What shall we do about dinner?" Late that night, as Eddie slept beside me, I was awoken by the sound of a man wailing. It was so tortured and insistent, I got out of bed and opened the sitting room window and poked my head out. He was standing at the corner of Castle Street, wearing an anorak that was hanging off one shoulder. There was another man with him. They looked to be in their late 20s or early 30s, and he was tugging at his friend's jacket, trying to bear-hug him into submission, like one boxer clinching another. They staggered a little together, and then the howling resumed. Against the wall was a heap of black rubbish bags awaiting collection, and he began to kick at them. Well, the second man stood there, his hands on his hips and looking down the street, like someone waiting for a dog to do its business. One of the bags burst, and his innards spilled onto the footpath. But he kept kicking, and then another one split and caught on the toe of his shoe. I think the indignity of that set him off again, for he became even more tormented. Finally, violently, he shook his foot free, and then he stumbled up Market Street and into the night, his friend trailing defeatedly behind. I was awed by the man's anguish, or rather by the force of its expression, and I had trouble getting back to sleep. When I described the scene to Eddie in the morning, he shook his head with bemused, absent-minded interest, the way he did when I told him a dream I'd had. "I wonder what happened to him," I said. And Eddie said, "He was rat-arsed, that's what." Then he kissed my cheek and headed off to work. I was unsettled in the weeks that followed. I felt itchy and nearly petulant with boredom. Eddie's ease irked me. A resentment had surfaced in me after that night out, which had something to do with my life having been decided and defined, with the admission that I had not entirely submitted to that finality, and with the fact that Eddie didn't see this, or couldn't see it. "You're made up now," I heard the boy say. I thought of the hotel owner, his eyes on me, his proprietorial tone. My being Eddie's wife somehow gave him the permission to speak to me like that. I felt repulsed by it. I also felt a shiver of desire. One afternoon, coming home from doing the shopping with a bag of groceries in each hand, I was passing by the open door of a pub on Wine Street, one of those dark, unsavory spots I had frequented the summer before I met Eddie. I hadn't gone into a pub on my own since that summer, but in I went. A guy behind the bar with a long ponytail served me a pint, which I took to a table in the corner. There weren't many people there. It was midweek, and after eyeing me with mild curiosity, the few who were there went back to their conversations. A copy of the previous day's Irish Times was lying on the table next to mine, and I picked it up. Over the next 2 hours, I spoke to no one but the bartender, who served me 2 more pints and a glass, without question. A fact that sent a strange thrill through me, as though I were breaking the law. When people started to trickle in, around 5:30, I finished my drink and left, swaying slightly on the short walk home. That night we had a fight. Eddie came home soon after I did. He opened a bottle of wine while I cooked dinner. Almost immediately he realized I'd been drinking. He asked me who with, and I said, "No one." "Alone?" he said, and I said, "Well, I was out." When I told him where I'd been, he said, "Why on earth would you go in there?" "Why wouldn't I?" "Well, it's not much of a way to spend an afternoon," he said. "I enjoyed myself." He rolls his eyes. "Oh, don't be dull," I said, in a tone I hoped was teasing. He looked at me, puzzled. "Is this the first time you've done that?" he said, meaning sit in the pub all afternoon. His tone was tinged with disapproval. It was the first time, and yet I felt disproportionately guilty, as though this were a habit I'd kept hidden from him. I also resented his judgment, which sounded disconcertingly parental. "What if it wasn't?" I said. "Would you be ashamed of me?" "Did you do something to be ashamed of?" "I did not," I said. "Then what are you talking about?" What was I talking about? It was my first flailing attempt to push him away. Even in the dimness of my self-knowledge, some part of me could see that. "I don't know," I said. "Well, maybe you should think about it." "I know," I said flatly. "You know you don't know." He threw me a look, condescending and gently dismissive. It seemed to say he'd been put on earth to indulge me. "Maybe you should have married one of your pals from the band." I looked at him. He got up from the table. I hadn't told him about that night. I could have. I hadn't done anything wrong. But maybe I wanted to see if he'd hear about it. And he had. Eddie kept me closer to him after that, at least for a while. And I didn't know whether it was out of contrition, perhaps he regretted having scolded me, or whether he was afraid I might be drifting from his orbit. It was around this time, during the 3rd year of our marriage, the year before we moved to the house under the mountain, that we began to drink more, and there were many mornings I awoke with a sharp, thrumming pain behind my eyes, and a quiver in my hands, and a feeling that we were avoiding each other's eyes. The nights would begin pleasantly enough. We'd meet in town, or drive out to the point for an after-work pint, with a plan to come home and cook. But then we would decide to have our dinner out, and there would be wine, too much of it, and instead of going home after the meal, we would go on for a late drink somewhere, because why not? Every now and then, the night felt like a wave we could catch, reminiscent of our beginnings. But more often, an edginess or a melancholy seemed to make its way into our drinking. There were times I felt I knew Eddie less well than ever, and I was shocked by whatever chutzpah or hubris had allowed us to undertake such an enormous thing as marriage. There were also days that reminded me why I'd married him, days that seemed to relegate any unpleasantness or regret to the realm of temporary blindness or simple misconception. One afternoon, Eddie phoned me from work and said he was coming home early, and asked if I'd like to go mussel picking at Kalina Moor in Strand Hill. He said we hadn't done that since our first summer, and did I remember how much I'd enjoyed it. When we got to the beach, he reminded me how to go for the mussels lowest down on the rocks, because they'd got less sun, and to choose those with the sharpest edges, as that meant they were younger. The tide was out, so that the sandbanks a few hundred meters from where we picked were exposed, and in the distance we could see seals. Eddie knelt on the rocks, his trousers tucked into his rubber boots, the sleeves of an old jumper pushed up to his elbows. He was filling a bucket, and I was on an adjacent rock, filling mine. When he straightened, he waved to me and smiled. A few minutes later, I heard him behind me. "Got enough?" he said, and held out his hand for my bucket. We climbed down onto the sand, and, for whatever reason, he set both the buckets down and put his arms around me and pressed me to him. I could see over his shoulder a honey-colored sky, the dune grass bending on the slopes. He gave my hair a tug so that my face was lifted to his, and he kissed me. Then he walked up to the beach where the rest of our things were, while I waited with the buckets. When he came back towards me, he was looking first out to sea, and then down at the sand, like a sad little boy. And I felt a wave of pity for him. It wasn't the first time, and I didn't know whether to feel alarmed or reassured, whether pity and love were mutually exclusive, or whether, on the contrary, they couldn't exist without each other. As we left the beach, black clouds pushed in out of nowhere, and by the time we were on the road, fat drops of rain had begun to fall, and the houses either side of us were smudges in the downpour. At home, Eddie steamed the mussels in white wine, and we ate enormous bowls of them with crusty bread, while the rain fell thickly beyond the sash window. Then we sprawled on the sofa, refreshed and tired from the sea air. I hadn't stopped watching him since the beach, as he was driving, as he cooked, as he uncorked the wine, and I felt as though I were witnessing something quietly spectacular. I felt in love again. I had the thought that all that was needed for us to thrive was for me to allow him to appear, even occasionally, in this light. I imagined him, not for the first time, in the distant future, and I was sure he would age into the sort of older man I had always liked the look of, weathered and sturdy and thick-set. I knew, too, that he would stick by me, and that that was not something one found easily, or cast too easily aside. I sat up on the sofa and straddled him. And we made love like that, hardly undressing at all, hardly speaking, the taste of the sea still on us. It felt creaturely and instinctive, and surprisingly gentle. Afterwards, as always, he seemed shy, so that I was left with a slightly uneasy conscience and an odd desire to protect him. Later, in bed, I lay there in the dark, thinking that if I could only give myself to this, to Eddie, without hesitation or doubt, I could stop this struggle and begin my life in earnest. We had talked about having a child, if in a rather glancing manner. Someday, accompanied by nervous laughter. We seemed to agree that it was the next right thing, the natural thing. We had gotten a kitten, a black and white female we named Olivia, and we made a disproportionate fuss over her, reporting to each other on her latest adorable antics. Conversations always laced with a certain self-consciousness, as though we suspected ourselves of displaced affection, aware of what we weren't yet brave enough to do. I turned on my side and touched my head to his shoulder. He was asleep. I imagined being pregnant with Eddie's child and felt a rush of desire that was overlaid with something unfamiliar. For an instant, I could feel myself falling under Eddie's spell again, as I had that first summer, when everything was strange to me, and I relied on him to interpret the world. I was sure that was what pregnancy and the early years of motherhood would mean. A deepening of my dependence on him. A wave of aversion passed through me, but so did a feeling of smugness. Something I was sure I had detected time and time again in families. Those sealed-off, self-regarding little units. On the one hand, they repelled me. On the other, I envied them and wanted what they had. A family, I thought. Our family. In the days that followed, I regarded my husband with something like submissiveness or reverence, as though I were already carrying his child, and the fact had rendered me awestruck. One night, in the sitting room, he turned to me and said, "We should think about buying a house." And I clapped my hands, actually clapped them like a schoolgirl, and leapt off my chair to join him on the sofa. It took us 6 months, but one morning we found ourselves driving up the mountain road to view the house that would soon be ours. It had rained earlier, quite heavily, and now the sun was out. The mountain was a steel blue, and the wet grass glinted in the light. The land so lushly green it looked irradiated. We took possession in October, and it was truer than I could have dreamed that our move to the countryside felt, if only for a while, like a return to our better selves, to that blissful first summer of our beginnings. The day is dissolving into twilight by the time I get back to Monkstown. I've been in the house only 3 weeks, and already it feels like home, some part of me believing that everything I see here is the accrual of my own life, rather than the belongings of strangers. My friend's friends bought the place in the 70s, when a lot of these seafront houses had fallen into disrepair, or been divided into flats. There was no electricity in the house, and the light fittings and chandeliers had been removed, so that cables hung frayed from the ceilings. Now, the walls are lined with books. There is a closet full of china, a walled garden, kitchen drawers as big as suitcases. There are dainty three-legged mahogany side tables, silk-covered cushions on the sofas that face the open fire. The carpets are plush and spotless. Every house on this stretch of road has undergone a similar transformation. On the next street over, a terrace of about a dozen houses, there are some days as many as 6 jaguars parked. 6 seems to be the full complement. I count them on my way to Tesco. Every Thursday, a Hungarian handyman comes, and on Mondays, a Romanian woman cleans the house. Otherwise, it is just me, ascending and descending the stairs, like some historic home's tour guide without an audience. I have never lived in a house so big, and during my first week here, I aimed to spread myself among as many rooms as possible. I prowled the garden's depths, even at night. I wanted to know every corner of the place. Every tree and dormant flower, each painting and book. I wanted to plunge into this accretion of family and history and nation. I imagined the precise way I would occupy each of these rooms, and the sort of person I would become as I did. In the library, I saw myself sitting by the large window in the straight-backed chair, like some fusty old scholar, reading Clarissa and Tristram Shandy, and all the other great works that have hovered unread, over my life. In the enormous first-floor front room, with its broad white chaise longue, I would gaze at the sea from my reclining position, sipping tea from a china cup, as though in a period drama. In the kitchen, with its gigantic drawers of spices and pulses and exotic vinegars, I would concoct dishes I'd long meant to try, but for which I'd never got round to assembling the ingredients. Quickly, though, I found my presence contracting. I retreated from all those rooms, which is to say that I stopped imagining the lives I might live in them. Now I occupy less and less space, though whatever space I do occupy, I occupy intensely. The house is as cold as it is beautiful, but it is more than the desire to stay warm that is behind this gathering in of self. It feels like a rather obvious metaphor, for the swift descent from the illusion of plentitude to the actuality of limits, for the way life is so effective at narrowing our horizons. A child's world is infinite, not because the child is capable of realizing any dream, but because the child does not yet know just how many dreams she will need to forsake, how little time and energy and fortitude will actually be available to her in this lifetime. Now I take my air at night. My quota of 2 cigarettes on the little covered patio outside the kitchen sliding doors, and with feet firmly planted, I peer into the garden's far reaches. Beyond the end of the lawn, the upper half of the Protestant church, which dominates the crescent, looms like a giant risen from slumber. And when the night is cold and wet, and the moonlight falls on the yew tree, and its needles glint like tinsel, the spectacle of it all is more than satisfying. For though I lament the narrowing of worlds that comes with age, I know that, like all children, I overlooked much and took everything for granted, and that even into the early years of adulthood, when I thought about the world at all in that way, I mistakenly assumed that all of its good, beautiful things would come around again, and then again and again, until the time was right for me to pluck them. Now I am old enough to know that there are people I would like to see again, whom I have already seen for the last time. There are places I dream of returning to that I will never revisit, and that though a few things do come around again and offer themselves, many more do not. When I used to visit my mother in Florida, in the time before Stan's death, before the sadness settled on her, I felt stirrings of that old sense of possibility, of the largeness of life. I would arrive at their retirement condo and lie down in the spare room, on the too soft single mattress, between sheets I was sure I remembered from childhood, and I would feel each time the strange and sudden onset of hopefulness. It was, I thought, trace memories of youth, awakened by being back in my mother's care, of a time when I believed that the world awaited me and that its intentions were good. Whenever I left her at the end of those visits, there lingered between and within us a longing for each other that was tender and oddly intimate, like the longing of lovers. It unnerved me slightly, this feeling, but it didn't surprise me. She met Stan the year I went off to college. She had taken a cruise of the Pacific coast with her bridge pals. Stan was a widower and was the fifth wheel accompanying 2 couples, one of whom was casually acquainted with a friend of my mother's. Before they disembarked, a week later back in Portland, my mother and Stan swapped numbers. 1 year later to the day, they married. As they neared retirement age, a lot of their friends were relocating to Arizona, but they both loved the sea, and eventually they moved to Florida. On one of my visits to their condo in the last months of Stan's life, I was living in Nairobi then. We were all sitting in the living room in front of our 3 folding tray tables, eating dinner that had been delivered from the dining room. The food was rather good, but the dinners came in individual styrofoam boxes, each food group nestled in its own compartment. Even when we transferred the dinners to our plates, their components retained that air of separateness, as though wanting nothing to do with each other. Every night, my mother decried the use of styrofoam. Every night we watched Jeopardy. It was my mother's favorite show. I used to think that if I could do one thing for her, it would be to send her on a honeymoon with Alex Trebek. A cruise through the Bahamas, with lots of bridge and sunbathing and jumbo shrimp cocktail. Alex would dote on her, wooing her with his knowledge of absolutely everything. He would draw her out, like he does with his contestants, their banal idiosyncrasies elevated briefly to something interesting.